I'd like to welcome you to CSIS this morning for yet another interesting event on Mexico. This one obviously is entitled Mexico's Ongoing Political Party System Realignment and Its Implications. As I noted in the letter of invitation, you know, I think a lot of attention was paid to, you know, Fox's victory, and to some extent less attention was focused on... No, this was back... I'm talking about... In the letter of invitation, I backtracked to note that back then, when alternation of power took place in Mexico, the focus was on the historic victory of Vicente Fox, but not much attention was actually devoted to its implications for Mexico's political party system, and particularly the defeat of a party that had governed for 70, 71 years. And so that election victory set in motion political realignment that, interestingly enough, is still ongoing, and it has implications for governance, and I think it has implications, obviously, for the political party system in Mexico as well. We decided to invite our distinguished guests this morning, who are, I think in the letter of invitation, I refer to them as intellectuals and also as thinkers. And I think they definitely, I wasn't trying to kiss up to Sergio or Jorge. I think that they've earned both of those, I don't know, terms in terms of how you can describe both of them. Jorge, just a brief introduction, and I know you all have his bio, as many of you know, is the former Secretary of Foreign Affairs, political scientist, and prolific author of numerous publications. He is a professor at NYU, where he's the Global Distinguished Professor of Political Science and Latin American Studies, and a regular contributor to Reforma, as well as Newsweek International, and a member of the board of the Human Rights Watch. Sergio is, as many of you know, one of Mexico's most distinguished journalists and editors, also a syndicated columnist for Reforma. He actually, I think, has been able to target every medium because he's in the newspaper, he is on TV with two shows on Azteca, Entrevista con Sarmiento and Quinto Poder, and he must be cloned or something because he decided to then take on another responsibility, which is a daily radio show, La Red de Radio Red. And so I'm delighted that both of them, who have extremely busy schedules, were able to make their way up to Washington for this morning's session on what I think is an interesting topic. As all of you know, the format is very informal. Each of them will probably speak for, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, 25 minutes each. Then we'll open it up and invite everybody to you know, participate in a more informal, interactive session. And given that both of them have such a broad base of knowledge, I'm open, and I think they are as well, if questions are posed on other than the topic that is listed in the letter of invitation. I think we should try to take advantage of the fact that we have both of them here. I think that's about it. We decided that Sergio would start, since he prepared a very brief PowerPoint presentation that would help to set the context. Jorge would follow, and then we would open it up for the session. But Sergio and Jorge, again, thank you for being here. It's a pleasure to have you here. And Sergio, the floor is all yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Armand. Thank you all for being here. And it's important that we talk about the political system or the political party realignment in Mexico, if only for one very specific reason. Of course, political parties are important anywhere in the world, but in Mexico they actually have a legal monopoly over electoral positions, as Mr. Jorge Castañeda has found out when he tried to challenge the political party system. So knowing exactly what what the situation is, where the parties stand right now, I think it's a good idea. I don't really have a PowerPoint presentation. What I have are some information, some data that I think can help us start discussing the where each party stands right now. But it's important to point out that the system that we have right now is totally different than the one-party system that we had 10 years ago. There has been a dramatic change, and that's the good news. The bad news is that maybe we just don't have the instruments, the institutional instruments that would allow us to push policy forward and to push the country forward on the basis of the highly divided political party system that we are acquiring in Mexico right now. So this is what the Chamber of Deputies looked like between 2003 and 2006. Those are the number of deputies that each party had. I grouped all of the small parties together here in the green section, but it's very clear that even though the PRI had lost the presidential election in 2000, it still remained the largest political party in the Chamber of Deputies, and it made its weight felt throughout the years of the previous legislature. The PAN clearly had become a major party. It was the government party, but it was still in the minority. And, of course, the PRD had been the third party for a long time. The things changed quite dramatically in the election of 2006. Everyone's been looking at the presidential election. But I think one of the most important considerations is the fact that the National Action Party, the party of both former President Fox and President Calderon, has become the largest party in the Chamber of Deputies in the legislature that started in 2006 and that will run through to 2009. I don't have the second year there because people, deputies, do tend to change parties once in a while, so this is the situation that we have at this point. The salient points are the PAN is now the largest party in the Chamber of Deputies. That's very important. But for practical purposes and in the presidential system that we had in which we don't get to form the kinds of alliances that you have in a parliamentary system in Europe, basically the PAN still has to have the support either of the PRI or of the PRD in order to push legislation. Forging an alliance with the small parties is actually very difficult in Mexico. Basically what we've seen so far, and it's remarkable actually that we're seeing it, is even though the PRI members are questioning the government, are questioning the panistas, and in fact are becoming very critical at points, we are actually seeing a working alliance between the PAN and the PRI, and the PRD is mutually against almost any bill that is actually pushed by the PAN. To give you another idea, is that this Congress is actually working better than the previous legislature. The budget was approved unanimously in late 2006 with maybe 1-2% of changes on the budget that was submitted by President Calderon. So even though we do get to see the occasional fist fight and of course the insults that have actually been a feature of our Congress, of our Chamber of Deputies for the past maybe 10 years, the number of times that the parties are actually getting together and voting together is quite remarkable. If you consider that it isn't really possible to do anything unless you have some kind of an alliance, and especially if you take a look at the insults that usually are hurled across the aisles, and also the insults that are carried by the media from one party group and then the other. So this is the Chamber of Deputies, and there is the Senate. This is the previous legislature, The situation was very similar to the one that we had in the Senate. The PRI, in fact, had almost a real majority, had 46% of the seats in the Senate. The PAN was the second largest party. The PRD was the third. And it was, of course, very important for the PAN to reach an agreement with the PRI in order to push any bills in the Senate. And now, again, the PAN is the largest party. It has 52 seats out of 128. That's 40% of the seats in the Senate. And as I said before, there's a working alliance between the PRI and the PAN. Yesterday, Emilio Goicoechea was approved as a new ambassador of Mexico to Canada, in spite of the fact that the PRI had said that it wasn't going to support it. And, of course, the PRD voted against him and, in fact, stormed out of the Senate at one point. But the fact is that agreements are being reached. I'm told by Jorge Castañeda, who has very good sources, there was a bit of personal arm twisting, but I guess that's part of parliamentary politics anywhere. Arturo Sarucán was also approved as ambassador of Mexico to the U.S. just on Tuesday, if I remember correctly. And we're seeing legislative processes actually going pretty much on course, in spite of the fact that no party has a majority in the Senate at this point. This map has been widely discussed. You've probably seen this map at one point or another. But it shows us what the results of the presidential election of 2006 look like if you paint the states that were won by Andrés Manuel López Obrador in yellow and the states that were won by Felipe Calderón in blue, and you look at this very divided country with a few blotches of green and blue in places that you wouldn't expect to see them, but there's no doubt that we have a highly divided country and a country that's pretty much divided between a northern part of the country that it's more panista or more modern-oriented, according to some, or more globalization-oriented, and the southern part of the country, which is more perredista, more in support of Andrés Manuel López Obrador, and perhaps more conservative in the way it looks at the economy and globalization. Of course, this result, and you'll notice that there is no state that was won by the PRI in the 2006 presidential election, but I think if we were to assume from this that the PRI is actually out of the out of the race or the PRI is out of the political life of the country, would be totally wrong. In fact, what happened in the 2006 election is that Roberto Madrazo was a particularly bad candidate, and that, of course, the contest was polarized between Calderón and Andrés Manuel López Obrador, and people wanted to vote for one of the two because they actually saw that Madrazo was going to be in a distant third. If you take a look at the deputy elections, and then you'll see that the PRI remains strong in certain areas of the country, in spite of the fact that Madrazo's coattails almost drowned the party. But you can still see fairly stable, fairly significant presence of the PRI. These are elections in which the PRI won in straight district contest. We also have a proportional representation system that is not actually reflected in this map. If we take a look at the Senate election results, we see this. These are again direct results, direct elections. They're not proportional representation or minority elections, but the PRI remains a force. It's clearly. It clearly had a terrible election in 2006, but that doesn't mean that it is out of the of the panorama in Mexico. In 1989, and this was not too long ago, this was what Mexico looked like. There was only one state governed by the PAN, by an opposition party, and the rest of the country was priista. In fact, before the Baja California election of the summer of 1989, no opposition candidate had ever won a governorship election in Mexico. And of course, that has changed little by little. This was 2001. I'm including as yellow, as PRD, the states in which the PRD has won in an alliance. And even if you look at what we have right now, it's still pretty much a priista country. The PRI has been particularly strong in winning governorship elections, and my guess is that we're still going to see a pretty strong PRI within the next months or within the next years. So the idea that just because the PRI was soundly defeated in 2006. That means that the PRI is out of the picture. That it's completely wrong, because the power that is exercised by the governors in various parts of the country is actually quite significant. These are the figures that I wanted to show you. That's all I have to show you in terms of data. But I think it's interesting. If you look at public opinion polls in 2007. You'll realize that one of the things that we've seen is that the PRD has had a decline ever since the election of 2006, mostly because of the positions, the radical positions assumed by Andrés Manuel López Obrador and his followers. And in fact, this has generated a major controversy within the PRD, because many PRDistas believe that if the party continues to radicalize itself, then it'll come a moment when they'll actually lose most of its political support. But what's happened, in fact, is that in most public opinion polls that I've seen, the Could we just close that? We don't need it anymore. Yeah. In most public opinion polls, we'll see that the support for Andrés Manuel and the PRD has actually stabilized at around between 16% and 20%, depending on the poll. This is actually quite a blow when you consider that the party had 35% of the vote in 2006. But the PRD has reached bottom, and there are good indications that it might actually get stronger as time goes by, especially now that Andrés Manuel López Obrador is not out blockading main streets in Mexico City and projecting the image of a wild-eyed radical. The PAN is at this point the strongest party in the country. This is probably a very peculiar position for a party that actually grew up and developed, always being in the opposition. But probably that's also one of its main risks. The PRI has gone down so much that it's bound to rebound. And even though the PRD had its best performance ever in 2006, it went down so much after the elections because of its very radical attitudes and very radical condemnation of what it called electoral fraud. That my impression in knowing what usually happens in Mexico is that they're both bound to rebound. This year we're going to have a number of elections that are crucial. Of course, one of them is Yucatan, and the other one is Baja California. In both states, the PAN is the government right now, but the candidacy of the PAN in Yucatan resulted in a very dividing contest, and the losing contender for the candidacy, Ana Rosa Payán, left the party, and she's actually very, very popular in Yucatan. So there's going to be a tremendous challenge for the PAN in Yucatan. And in Baja California, where the PAN has been stable since 1989 when it won the governorship election. This time they're going to face a major challenge because the PRI has fielded Jorge Jancron as its candidate. And Jorge Jancron is hated by the political elite of Mexico. Of course, he has an awful reputation. But when you have a stash of $500 million, you can do a lot of damage, as Jorge Jancron has already proved in the past when he won the elections in Tijuana 2 years, almost 3 years ago. So that's the panorama. I think, you know, we can talk about this from now on. I know that Jorge has some other subject matters in mind, and we can of course talk about them. But I thought it was a good idea to start with an idea what the party realignment has actually looks like right now in Mexico. Armando.
Sergio, thank you very much. Jorge.
Thank you, Armand. Thank you for having us both here at CSIS in Washington. And thank you mainly for doing this, Armand, on such a special day.
Thank you.
He's 35 today. It's his birthday. So happy birthday. And thanks for taking time out. The 35 you can is about as accurate as everything else I'm going to say. I would just make a couple of comments about a few of the points Sergio made, just to add to them, and then try and draw some conclusions from this very clear analysis of the realignment that he made, because I think that sets the stage for what political implications we can see in the future regarding these issues. I would mention three aspects just very specifically. One of the problems that we have in Mexico, like elsewhere in politics, is that public opinion and those of us who try to shape public opinion do not necessarily have the time or the patience always to keep all of the information at hand. And so sometimes we try and find novelty, innovation, where there isn't necessarily innovation. Let me just give you two examples. One that Sergio mentioned, and he's quite right on both of them in terms of these being important points, but I'm not sure they're new. A lot has been made about the fact that the budget was approved unanimously in December, and that this is a sign of how the times are changing. Fox's three budgets were all approved unanimously. The first legislature of the Fox administration. Right now, when one has the image of the Fox term having been a term of tremendous conflict and paralysis between the executive branch and the legislative branch, and it was all of that, except that the three first budgets were approved unanimously. And it is also true that the two first ambassadors were approved. And all Calderon and my successor at the foreign ministry have to do now is get the other 108 approved. They're doing well. I mean, two every 3 months is good. By the end of the term, they may actually get everybody approved. And a lot has been made of the fact that President Calderon directly intervened to get the votes, and I'm glad he did. I'm not sure he'll be able to do that with all 110 appointments that the foreign minister has to make and send to the Senate. 110. I got one turned down, and it was my mistake because I sent up a consul to Austin who didn't speak English. I'm not sure it's that necessary to speak English in Austin. That's a different story. But the Senate thought it was. So now, I think from Sergio's analysis, which I share entirely in terms of the realignment, its implications, I see three possibilities, three avenues for the next 3 years at least. After 2009, it's a different story, and I'll come back to that in a moment because I think that's the most important point that Sergio was making. I think there are three possibilities that the president has to try and get things done with this new Senate, new Chamber of Deputies, new gubernatorial alignment, and new party alignment. Regardless of which one is more likely or which one he prefers, I don't know, but I do see three. I'd start first with the possibility of getting something done, some sort of reforms approved. I would discard any major constitutional reform because the numbers really don't add up there. It would be very hard to get a two-thirds majority in either of the two chambers, much less in both of them, and in 20 state legislatures, which is what a constitutional amendment requires in Mexico. But there are some reforms, for example, tax reform, pension reform in the East, if for the state workers, perhaps some reforms of the labor legislation, the federal labor law, not Article 123 of the Constitution, but the federal labor law can be changed with a simple majority. Those would be the possibilities. I'm not sure I see too many more, but let's take those three. My sense is that it's going to be very difficult for that to happen, in spite of the realignment and in spite of the fact that there may be a little more control by the leadership of the PAN of the PAN caucus and by the leadership of the PRI of the PRI caucus, which were really two of the main problems that Fox faced. It was not so much an issue of agreement or disagreement. It was that the parties are so divided that whoever you make a deal with, there's always someone else who didn't make that deal in the same party, and that someone else has a third or half of either the members of the House or of the Senate. It's not impossible that they could get this done, that something can be done. My sense is that it's very unlikely. The institutional reform, which is, I think, the most important reform, changing the electoral laws, changing the party monopoly that we talked about, abandoning the U.S. system of campaign airtime purchases and campaign financing, establishing a runoff for the presidential election, at least, so we don't have another president with 35% of the vote. None of these reforms seem to me very likely. They're not impossible. The Senate did approve a couple of weeks ago a sort of a guillotine law whereby they have a year in which to come up with some sort of institutional reform blueprint. My sense is that giving themselves a year was mainly a political maneuver carried out by the PRI in order to give the impression of movement, but I'm not sure they actually will have anything to show a year from now. So this option of getting a few things done, even if they're not earth-shattering, but at least something, while I wouldn't discard it completely, I'm not very convinced that this is likely. And I would mention that although President Calderon has only been in office for 2.5 months, the two houses have been now in office for 6 months, and they have done practically nothing. They approved two laws, important ones. One has to do with the Manglares on the coasts, and the other one, which is a very important one, has to do with, among other things, el desamor y la indiferencia en las parejas. Now, I'm all for that. I mean, I think these are things that should be legislated. I don't think that you can just get away with
jealousy.
No, also jealousy. I'm sorry, I miss jealousy. Desamor, indiferencia y celos. The three of them.
Yeah, six years in prison for jealousy. Yeah. If you're a man.
If you're jealous or you generate or you provoke jealousy, which of the two?
If you're jealous. If you are okay. Obsessively jealous.
That's punished, but it doesn't matter if you make somebody jealous. Well, that's good. I'm glad. These are, extraordinarily important pieces of legislation, as we all know. Now, they've been now in office for 6 months. Remember, they took office on September 1st. Actually, more than 6 months. It's going to be 7 months in a week. It's something to think about, that this is what they've done in 7 months. I'm not saying that they won't do more in the next 2 years that they have in the House and 4 years that they have in the Senate, but so far it's not that encouraging. The second option that the president has is a little bit what Fox tried to do and then desisted because he got cold feet. in April of 2001. And that is to use the proverbial bully pulpit. Not so much to get things done, but to show the country why you can't get things done. And then to use that argument and that line of conduct in order to bring huge pressure to bear on the House and on the Senate in order maybe further on down the line to get things done. Of course, the tremendous obstacle to that in Mexico is the absence of re-election. The bully pulpit in principle only works if the guy who you're pressuring from beneath, from below, wants to get reelected and is scared of not being reelected if he doesn't or she doesn't behave one way or another, according to this new law or any other way. It's hard to generate that kind of movement. It's hard to use the bully pulpit without reelection. And, of course, it's a vicious cycle. In order to establish re-election, you need institutional reforms. In order to get the institutional reforms, you need a majority. In order to have a majority, you have to cut a deal with these guys, and they don't want to. So the difficulty is there. My sense is that this is the only real possibility that the country and the government has to make any real headway almost on any front. Only if President Calderón presents a high-energy, high-intensity program to the country and goes out and fights for it and mobilizes society and public opinion in favor of it, will it be possible to push the Congress, and particularly the PRI in the Congress, into doing these things. I agree completely with Sergio that the PRD is it's a waste of time, that you're not going to convince the PRD of practically anything, not even of who's going as ambassador to Canada. So I have nothing against Canada, but this is not the most important appointment in the Mexican federal government. And if they stormed out of the Senate because of that, I'm not sure that they're going to go along with changing Article 27 of the Constitution, etc. What I think the president will do, unfortunately, is go for the third option, which is wait till 2009. Basically, try and govern as competently as possible, establishing as much of a difference as possible with the Fox administration on atmospherics and on non-substantive matters, and hope that his party can win a majority in the 2009 elections. I think that's his real bet. That's the third option he has. And unfortunately, I think that's the one he's going to follow. Why do I say unfortunately? For two reasons. One, because it condemns the country to three more years of paralysis, and that will be three of Cedillo, six of Fox, and three of Calderón. Well, that's pushing it. I mean, 12 years is a long time. Of course, if this were to be the case, some questions emerge from this situation. Maybe the problem is not what a lot of people thought. In other words, the problem was not political skills or not skills, etc. Maybe the problem was that there's something wrong with Mexico's institutional design. Because if you have four legislatures, three presidents, eight ministers of the interior or whatever, and none of them can get anything done, well, maybe it's not a question of political skills. Maybe it's a more complex underlying issue. That's the first reason I'm not convinced that this is a good idea, but I think that's what he's going to do. And the second reason, with which I'll conclude, so we can open this up, is to go back to what Sergio was saying. I agree with him completely that the PRD and the PRI are not going to remain as weak as they are right now. So the likelihood of the PAN getting 43% of the vote in the 2009 legislative elections, 43% gives you an automatic majority in the House. Doesn't change the Senate. There are no 2009 elections in the Senate, but there are in the House. The likelihood of getting 43% of the vote for the PAN in 2009 is just not very high, in my opinion. I think the PRI will come back. It won't go back to where it was. I don't think we will see a PRI ever again with 35, 36% of the vote nationally. But I think we can see a PRI with 27, 28, 29% of the vote. And I think the PRD will not go back to 35 either, but will not necessarily stay at 16 or 17 because it has Mexico City, has a lot of strength in other important states, like the state of Mexico, like Michoacán, like Guerrero, like Chiapas. Oaxaca is a state where logically it should end up carrying, becoming a majority when the legislative elections take place. So I just don't see how the PAN and Felipe Calderón can come up with an absolute majority, 251 congressmen, in the 2009 elections. So waiting for that, I don't think, gets you anything. But my impression is that what the president has probably decided to do is that, to wait for 2009 and hope for the best. I'm sure there are some baseball fans here, and seeing from the young ones, I'm sure, don't know that. But as a matter of fact, you may have read, because his gentleman died a few months ago, for the it was old saying for the Milwaukee Braves in 1958. They won the pennant in 58 or 59 in the National League, and they had two pitchers, and that was it. And so they asked the manager, so what are you going to do? On the third day, you say, spawn, sane, and pray for rain. And that's basically what Calderón is doing. Thanks.
I'd like to make a comment before we go into the rest of the group. I think, Jorge and I think we've been debating for the past 20 years or 25 years, so we'll continue to do that. I think you're being too harsh on Congress. Of course, the new law about women has some ridiculous things about trying to regulate jealousy, and I find it very difficult to understand how you'll do that. But it has a little item about violence against women that I think it's relevant. It actually has very distinctive, very harsh penalties for violence against women. And there have been other laws that have been approved, the pederasty laws, the new defamation and libel laws that I think are good things to have. And it is clear that the most important reforms are still further down the road, but that always happens at the beginning of an administration. In fact, you start getting the political jockeying at first, and you make agreements. You try to come up with a bill that would be acceptable to a majority of the legislators, and then you usually have a rush of legislation being approved at the end. That's basically how the system works in Mexico and anywhere else. I know Calderón is pushing in this year for reforms on pensions, fiscal reform that might not be the whole enchilada, but you know, even if it's not the whole enchilada, it could still be have some good points, and labor reform that would be more or less based on the one that has been in Congress for the next for the past 2 years. So I think it's still a bit too early to sort of laugh at Congress and just claim that because they're trying to legislate jealousy that we just would simply have to dismiss this Congress.
No, but what's wrong with jealousy?
Okay, let me ask both of you a question. Jorge mentioned the challenges that President Fox encountered as a result of the intra-party divisions. We just went through the PRI's leadership convention. The PRD is approaching its own leadership convention. I'm curious as to how the both of you see the state of intra-party divisions, both within the PRI and the PRD, and what the implications of that and how it unfolds has on Calderón and possibly even the midterm elections. Your analysis is accurate in that you're saying that, you know, it's going to be difficult for Calderón to obtain a majority. But at the end of the day, any seats gained that get him closer towards perhaps building an alliance, it's not an all-or-nothing type of approach, I think. At the end of the day, if instead of getting 20, he only needs 10, then it's a lot easier to horse trade 10 than it is to horse trade 20. But just if you can comment on the intra-party divisions within the PRI and the PRD, that would be great.
You know, very briefly, I still think that the three parties, the PAN is the same situation, are very deeply divided. And consequently, that one of the main obstacles that Cedillo faced, that Fox faced, Calderon faces, which is that there is no central interlocutor with whom you can cut a deal, and that that deal then be respected and that everyone deliver on it. In the case of the PAN, the division perhaps is less evident within the PAN, but it is very significant between the PAN and the presidency, or the PAN and the government. Calderon has less sympathy for his group and his view of the world, etc., in the PAN today than Fox did 6 years ago, because Manuel Espino has an agenda, whereas Luis Felipe Bravo Mena 6 years ago didn't. They just didn't personally like Fox, but that's it. Whereas the Panistas now like Calderon, but they have a very different agenda. And we can come back to this perhaps on foreign policy in a few minutes. In the case of the PRI, yes, they elected Beatriz Paredes, and the election went off better than most people would have thought. But I don't know of any PRIista who thinks that Beatriz Paredes has absolutely any leverage whatsoever over someone like Beltrones or someone like Gamboa. I mean, these are tough cookies. These are the real thing. Gamboa's been around since 1979. As far as I can remember, he is the longest surviving top-level PRIista we've seen ever, more than Jorge Hank's father, who was pretty good too. But the Gamboa has now been at top-level positions for a quarter of a century. And Manlio Fabio Beltrones is one of the most skillful and bold politicians the PRI has in the country today. So frankly, I don't see what difference it makes who won and who didn't win. The problem is that it's a deeply divided party. And finally, the PRD is even more divided. So you have to make deals, but who do you make the deals with? And now, if this were a new problem, fine, but this is exactly the same problem that Cedillo faced between 97 and 2000 when the PRI lost the majority in the House. It's exactly the same problem Fox faced. I'm not sure it's any better. If anything, it's probably worse. I would hope, and I'll stop here, that at some point these three parties disintegrate and that we have a real realignment where different groups from each one of the three align themselves with groups that are close to them in another party instead of maintaining this very artificial grouping. But of course, if what's at stake is roughly the $1 billion in party financing, taxpayers' party financing that took place last year, it's not for the IFE, just for the parties, well, it's a good reason for not realigning. I mean, it's a 1 billion good reasons.
Well, I roughly, basically agree with Jorge. There's a battle in all three parties, and you know that's I guess normal in any democracy. There, people in there are fighting for ego, for money, and for power. So we'll continue to see that. In the PAN, the difference between Manuel Espino, who represents the most conservative part of the PAN, and Felipe Calderon, who represents more progressive part of the party, is clearly going the side of Calderon. They've had a number of encounters, and Calderon seems to be winning. Calderon knows the party very well. Calderon knows the party inside out. He's worked within the party. He was chairman of the party, secretary general of the party. He was raised within the party. His father was a founder of the party. And from what I have seen in the battles between Espino and Calderon, Calderon is winning. The battle for for the presidency of the PANs in the federal district was very important. Manuel Espino was backing Carlos Gelista, and Felipe Calderon was backing a woman, Mariana Pérez del Campo. Mariana, I can't remember exactly. Gómez del Campo, Mariana Gómez del Campo, and even though Carlos Gelista was incumbent, Mariana actually won fairly easily. I see also that the leaders of the party in Congress, even though they weren't put there by Felipe or beginning to actually move towards Felipe's side. That's both Santiago Krill, who was Felipe's rival in for the candidacy of the PAN, and Héctor Larios. I've seen many indications that they're beginning to put some distance with Espino, and I wouldn't, I think what's going to happen basically is that Espino is eventually going to be replaced and sent as ambassador to, some major banana republic, and that'll be the end of his challenge to Calderon. The PRI is very complex, as Jorge puts it. Part of the problem that Fox had was that he really didn't have anyone to speak with within the PRI, and if he made an agreement with Beatriz when Beatriz Paredes was the head of the PRI legislators, that agreement didn't stuck. Wasn't valid for Roberto Madrazo, or wasn't valid for other groups within the PRI, and clearly Beatriz Paredes, now as president of the party, well, she will be so on March 4th, she's going to have to negotiate with Manlio Fabio Beltrones and with Emilio Gamboa. One thing that Beatriz has, of course, is the money, the political money, and as long as we don't have any major penalties on the parties because of the elections of 2006, which could happen, Beatriz is going to have a lot of money, and that money will actually get her loyalties within the party. She's going to have to work little by little, and the time of definition is going to come in 2009 when the decisions are made on who is going to go next to the Chamber of Deputies. And the PRD is actually the most divided of all parties. There's a major division. Everyone within the PRD makes a show of supporting Andrés Manuel López Obrador and his cause. But clearly there are two groups, or three groups, in fact, that are getting tired of the leadership of López Obrador. One includes Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas and his son, Lázaro Cárdenas, who wants to be president. And actually, Cuauhtémoc has been in a challenge against Andrés Manuel López Obrador since last year. Jesús Ortega, who's a moderate within the party, is totally upset at the fact that the party has been taken hostage by López Obrador and his group. And then there's Marcelo Ebrard and the party in the federal district. So far, they're loyal to Andrés Manuel, but the loyalty will not last very long because Marcelo Ebrard wants to be president, and Andrés Manuel López Obrador thinks he's president, but he wants to be reelected as president. So there's bound to be a combat between them. Amalia García, who's another major leader, has remained sort of neutral so far, but it is clear to me that the one party that's most divided at this point is the PRD.
I know, Sergio, you joke, but it might be the only way to get re-election in Mexico.
Maybe.
Why don't we open it up for Q&A and get everybody involved? I know Diana wanted to start, and then we'll move on.
Diana Negroponte from Brookings. I'd like to take your thesis of political realignment to the state of Oaxaca and to help us understand whether we're seeing realignment in the contest between the teachers and the governor, or whether we are seeing a persistence of the traditional predominance and repression of any contest by society.
What we're looking at in Oaxaca is a battle between power groups, and it's a complex battle, like any other battle in Mexico. Ulises Ruiz, the governor, represents a branch of the PRI. He's very close to Roberto Madrazo and to the former governor, José Murat. He's not liked by many groups within the party. And he's using the weapons that PRIista governors have always used to gain loyalty. He uses money, and of course, he appears to have used repression. He actually only used repression once, and it actually backfired tremendously. And ever since, in fact, he has been tremendously timid about using repression. So much so, in fact, that for 6 months the city was taken by one of the groups that's actually challenging him. You have a very complex situation because there are a lot of groups that are involved. There's Section 22 of the Teachers Union. This is a very radical section of the Teachers Union, which is aligned to the PRD. The PRD has tremendous power in the state of Oaxaca. They had the support during the most of last year. They had the support of the APO, which is an informal alliance of radical groups that consider the PRD too moderate or too conservative. But in this point, they decided that they had to join forces with Section 22 of the union, which is actually more closely aligned to the PRD, in order to get rid of Ulises Ruiz, which represents a chieftain that they don't agree with. It's not that they want to democratize the state, it's just that they want their own chieftain in place. Elba Esther Gordillo, who used to be a member of the PRI, who is now an independent political operator, is pushing a new section of teachers into the state, Section 59, trying to gain control of regain control over that section of the syndicate. That section of the syndicate has always been against Elba Esther Gordillo because they consider her too moderate for their positions, and because they always looked at her as a priesta. Now she's not a priesta; she was expelled from the party, but she has her own political agenda and is trying to regain control over Oaxaca. Basically, we're looking at a major political battle between different groups that are each pursuing its own purposes. There was repression in Oaxaca. Yes, there was repression after the city was taken for 6 months by a radical group that didn't allow any normal commercial activities or tourism activities in a city that actually lives on tourism. Probably, in fact, one of the problems with Oaxaca was that it took too long for the federal government to actually start acting, and when it finally started to act, the situation was already too complex. I don't expect to see the Oaxaca situation resolved very quickly, just because these groups, Section 22, the APO, which are the radicals that are now or are sometimes allied with Section 22, which is actually allied with the PRD, the Elba Esther part of the teachers union. I mean, the situation is too complex because there are too many people trying to get control over the state. Few of these people are actually really looking for a democratic the building of a democratic society. They basically want to have the spoils of a state that gets 95% of its revenue from the federal government.
Sergio, you did a nice job at summarizing a mess. Why don't we go over here?
I think in general terms, and then on three specific issues, what the president has decided to do, I would say in an increasingly conscious and deliberate way, is to have a very clear double discourse, to tell the priestas and the PRD and the Congress what they want to hear, and then tell the Americans and the Europeans what they want to hear. Obviously, the two discourses are radically opposed, one to the other. Just as an example, because it happened yesterday when the new ambassador to Washington was approved, or the day before yesterday, on the one hand, he led many people to believe, including those who ratified him and including Sergio in his column, that immigration was not a central issue, and two, that Mexico would not lobby in the U.S. for immigration reform, which is, according to some, a very sensible position, the two aspects. And then he gave an interview to the Latin American Advisory Report in English, addressed to the United States, where he says exactly the opposite, that his most important issue is immigration reform and that Mexico is going to hire, this is for the K Street people, huge groups of lobbyists, like with NAFTA in 1993, to lobby for immigration reform. I happen to agree completely with the second stance. Sergio happens to agree completely with the first stance. But there is a problem. We can't agree with both. It is one or the other. This is even more true, as we've seen with Chavez in the last two or three months. On the one hand, the new foreign minister talks the talk that the priistas and the perredistas love. Non-intervention, we want to be friends with everybody, we're not going to fight with anybody, human rights is important but not too important, democracy is important, but who are we to go around telling people what kind of elections to hold, blah, 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 blah. This is the sort of thing that makes all of my PRI and PRD friends very happy. They really enjoy that immensely. And at the same time, President Calderón says very intelligent, sensible things in Davos and in Spain and in London about combating the type of populist policies, authoritarian policies, non-respect for human rights policies in Venezuela and elsewhere in Latin America. Again, you can agree with either of the two, and there are good arguments to be made for Mexico following either of the two positions, but not for both at the same time. He was caught, Calderón, by the PAN and by the PRD during his trip to Europe. The PAN went further than Calderón in terms of criticizing Chavez, etc., whereas the PRD was very upset at him for not doing what they thought he had committed himself to doing, which was to stop being nasty to Chavez and to Fidel, or Raúl, or both. What will he do if he has to make a decision? First, hope he doesn't have to make a decision, and keep hoping. For example, hopefully, and he may be right on this, there will not be a vote either at the Human Rights Council in Geneva this year or at the Third Committee of the United Nations of the Assembly on country issues, on Cuba, and on in particular, and the peer review will not take place this year, so Mexico won't have to vote, which is the ideal situation, I guess, for any government, in that, given those difficulties. Hopefully, they can avoid it. It's not really in Mexico's hands, even though we chair the council in Geneva. It's not in our hands to determine whether there will or will not be a vote. Secondly, we'll have to see what happens at the OAS. If José Miguel Insulza doesn't make any more strong statements about freedom of the press in Venezuela, then the other member countries won't have to defend him from Chavez's tirades and diatribes. But that depends on José Miguel not making those statements, which depends on Chavez not closing down any more radio stations or television stations. I don't think it's in Calderón's hands whether that's going to happen or not. The same is true, of course, the big problem, imminent problem, but that's not in his hands either. Apparently it's in nobody's hands, is what happens when Fidel dies. Not so much what happens with Cuba, but the big decision for Calderón, of course, is whether he goes to the funeral or not. It's a tough one, very, very tough one. Because on the one hand, the PRD and the PRI will go absolutely crazy if he doesn't go, and they will make life miserable for him in the Congress on this issue. On the other hand, if he does go, what will be the company he will be keeping in Havana at the funeral? Who else is going to be there? And who's not going to be there? So, as I say, hopefully he can avoid making any of these decisions without even mentioning the question of immigration reform in the United States. If there is a bill that looks more or less like McCain-Kennedy sometime in the next 3 or 4 months, what's Mexico's stance on it going to be? We know what the previous government stance would have been. We don't know what the new government stance would be. Ideally, I imagine they would prefer that there not be a bill so that they don't have to take a stance on it. But as you know, McCain-Kennedy has a lot of very specific issues, very specific items about Mexican cooperation. Sometimes they refer to euphemistically as countries to the south that have a border and a lot of people who come here. they don't want to say Mexico. It's all right. But I think pretty much everybody knows who they're referring to. It's a very tough situation for him because, and I'll stop here, Calderón is a Democrat, and he's someone who believes sincerely, deeply, in questions of human rights, democracy, markets, a normal, rational relationship with the United States. These are his convictions. He has also bought lock, stock, and barrel the conventional wisdom that Mexico's divergences or disagreements with Cuba and with Venezuela and with Argentina were Fox's fault, not their fault. The two things are somewhat incompatible. If Calderón can figure out a way to not agree with the Cubans on human rights, but be able to keep a human rights stance that is principled, then he will have squared the circle. And, I mean, it's only been 48 years that people have been trying and have been unsuccessful, so there's really no reason to believe why he can't do what nobody else has done the last half century.
Did you want to comment?
Just very briefly, and of course this is an issue that Jorge, well, these are issues that Jorge knows much better than I do. Sorry. What I know from conversations with people in the government is that in the matter of migration, the attitude of the government is going to have a lower profile and continue supporting the bills that are presently toyed around with in the states that are more amenable to the interests of Mexico, but not to have such a high profile as our former foreign minister, Jorge Castañeda, had. Is it good or bad? I don't know. As Jorge has said, we disagree on this issue. But that's what I think Calderón is going to try to do. Is it going to work? I just don't know. In the case of Venezuela and Cuba, President Calderón does want to get closer to the two governments without necessarily backing the human rights abuses or whatever faults these governments might have. I have good reasons to believe that, in fact, President Calderón has requested permission to travel to Cuba to meet with Fidel Castro, but that permission has not been granted. He tried to get closer. He tried to send goodwill signals to Chavez, and then, of course, in Davos, at the insistence of CNN anchor, eventually criticized Venezuela's attitude towards foreign investment and eventually got into trouble himself. I think Calderón is going to try to have a two-track policy in this sense, being softer on the outside and trying to maintain the certain principles more privately. I don't know if it's going to work, but I think that this is basically what he's trying to do.
Is there anybody on this side? In the back here. I don't know if we have a roaming mic. If we don't have a roaming mic, if you can just... Yeah, Kara, can you...
Hi, I'm Elsa Paraldi from the State Congress of Coahuila. And, my question is, well, during the Fox presidency, the state government of Coahuila had some friction because past a conscious situation Do you think Calderon will be able to soften that political friction, and how?
Well, what if people haven't heard, the Governor Humberto Moreira made a statement on Sunday saying that President Fox, on the wake of the Pasta de Conchos mine accident, which left 65 miners dead, he claims that he was pressured in a meeting in Los Pinos by President Fox to unjustly prosecute the leader of the mine workers union, Napoleon Gomez Urrutia. Is it true or isn't true? It's very hard to say. The government took a year to actually make the statement or make the accusation. President Fox hasn't said anything publicly, so either he's admitting that that conversation took place, or he just doesn't want to get involved in that kind of a discussion. It's hard to say. The miners' union is one of the most complex conflicts that we have in Mexico right now, and again, it involves money, it involves power, and we have a very complex line of entanglement. There are couple of groups of mining companies that are actually involved in this fight, and they're supporting different sides of the workers of the miners' union. There's on the one hand Grupo Minero Mexico, headed by Germán Larrea, and on the other hand there's AMSA, headed by the Ancira brothers. Everything seems to indicate that Grupo Minera Mexico has been supporting the dissident leadership in the union with the support of the federal government, former President Vicente Fox. President Calderon still hasn't made a decision what to do on this case. And Humberto Moreira, the governor of Coahuila, who received support during his campaign from Napoleon Gomez Urrutia, the leader of the miners' workers, and the Ancira brothers at AMSA, but they're on the other side. So this has become a political battle in a way, but it's also a battle for control of the mine workers' union. Napoleon Gomez Urrutia, of course, has a very good claim on the leadership of the union. His father inherited the union to him, and of course that's as democratic as you can get in a union in Mexico. But he does have control over the union because he controls most of the heads of the sections who were loyal to his father and now believe that the way to actually keep control over the union and the legal and illegal revenue that the union actually provides is by actually keeping Napoleon Jr. In charge of the mine. This is going to be an extremely difficult issue for President Calderon to decide because Napoleon's initial legal designation as leader of the union at the beginning of the Fox administration was controversial, at least. There are many reasons to believe that he didn't fulfill the basic requirement of having been a miner for 5 years. He had been a student at Oxford at that time. On the other hand, the dissident union leader that was accepted by Fox at the end of his administration became a leader with he basically went to something called the Comisión de Vigilancia, an overview committee at the union, which had three members, and one of the members didn't support this dissident union leader. He was the other member, and the other member's signature was apparently forged. So he basically actually replaced the leader of the union just with his own vote. So basically that's also illegal. Everything would be simple if you could just have an assembly or a convention and have a legal vote to decide who's going to be the next leader. But the two groups are unwilling to allow a democratic election and and thus the situation can get actually very tough. Right now, Napoleon Gomez Urrutia has effective control over maybe 70% of the union, which probably will give him the control over the union eventually. But it's going to be a very difficult situation because probably none of the two union leaders that are presently fighting for control should really be the union leader. And clearly they're getting illegal support and they're, you know, pushing money around and supporting, in one case, Governor Moreira in Coahuila. And on the other hand, the other side is actually closely aligned with the ruling party at the federal government. So it's a very messy situation.
Okay, Damien, and then we'll go over here to Jose.
Hi, Damien Merle with the International Republican Institute. There are many things that puzzle me about Mexico, but I just want to ask about two specific ones. One is, what do you make of all this sort of scandals or criticisms of President Fox, you know, having a public image after being president? I mean, to me and from the U.S. perspective, and I mean, you watch President Clinton and former President Bush doing work together. I mean, what could help us understand why Mexican society gets so angry about that? And the other one is, on this whole immigration, I think what Calderon has been trying to do is he's trying to put sort of the security, the border security issue, before he can become start talking about immigration, because I guess that's pretty much how we see the issue. And so I'm wondering what your take is on what he's trying to do on border security.
On the two issues, it is true that there is a tradition that former presidents in Mexico stay out of the limelight. This is less and less true, has been less and less true the last 10 or so years. Carlos Salinas never stayed out of it. I mean, he began a hunger strike two weeks after leaving office, which is not exactly staying out of the limelight. And he says, well, yes, but that's because they put my brother in jail. There's always a good reason, but and it is true that Mexican society tends not to like this too much, though I would perhaps establish some sort of the distinction between what the press says and what Mexican society thinks. Sometimes the two coincide and sometimes they don't. I think what Fox is doing is absolutely legitimate and right, and say, hey, wait a second, these were unwritten rules for pre-presidents. I'm the first non-pre-president the country has had in 80 years, and I don't believe in those rules, and I'm not going to respect them, period. One can then argue with the substance of what he says each time, and you can either agree with it or not, or you can think that he is making life complicated for President Calderon or saying something silly, etc. That's a different story. But the principle, I think, is one of those principles that should be eliminated in Mexico. There is no good reason why former presidents shouldn't say whatever they want to say, wherever they want to say it. And if people want to listen to them, they do. And if they don't want to listen, they don't. And if they agree with them, they do. And if they don't, they don't. Period. I frankly cannot share the outrage of the Mexican press and the commentocracy, as I've called it, on these issues. I just don't see why. On the immigration question, again, it's important to, I think, emphasize that from September 12th onward, the three successive foreign ministry administrations and the three successive interior ministry administrations have always tried to link security with immigration. This myth that the Mexicans didn't want to and the Americans did is just that, a myth, and the documents are there. The problem is that the Americans were not buying, and they probably still are not. That is, at the end of the day, there will be comprehensive immigration reform in the United States or not, pretty much regardless of what the internal security situation is in Mexico. Because at the end of the day, until today, there has not been a single incident of any terrorist threat to the United States from Mexico in now almost 6 years. which means that this is not something that concerns U.S. public opinion. U.S. public opinion can get upset about the people who were decapitated in Acapulco, but frankly, there haven't been a whole lot of tourists, American tourists in Acapulco for something like 45 years now. It's not that they stopped going to Acapulco because they're cutting people's heads off. I mean, so what? No, they don't go there anyway. So my sense is that that is a little bit of a straw dog. That is not the issue. Now, the real issue, and that's where Mexico and Calderón will have to make a very tough decision, because it's the same decision we had to make, and it's the same decision other presidents have had to make in Mexico, although each one has done it differently. What happens if and when there is comprehensive immigration reform and there is a temporary workers program of 250,000 to 400,000 visas per year and an increase in permanent visas and the legalization of most of the people here? And after that is done, the United States government asks the Mexican government, fine, you got pretty much what you wanted. Now, what are you going to do for me? Are you going to help us close the border, yes or no? And that's where Calderón is going to be in a difficult situation, because the United States, if all of this happens, is going to ask for that, whether Calderón lobbies or doesn't lobby, whether he likes it or doesn't like it, whether he thinks this is a great idea or not a great idea. And it's a very difficult decision to make. My sense has always been that if we get enough on visas, on temporary workers, on legalization, this is a good deal for Mexico. It's a good pragmatic deal. It's a good principle deal. It's a good rule of law deal. From every perspective, it's a good deal. But that is obviously not what the PRI believes, certainly not what the PRD believes, and not what many people who view this issue from a different perspective as mine, but view it with intelligence and with insight, as the case of Sergio and many others, believe either. So it's a very tough decision. But that's the real decision. It's not so much linking security. Everybody's been linking security with immigration since 9/11.
Sergio, did you want to comment? Why don't we just take the last question from Jose, and we'll wrap it up after that.
Jose Lopez Zamorano, Mexican News Agency, Notimex. I want to go one step behind in the immigration issue. If we assume for the sake of this conversation that the Mexican position is the one that was more recently articulated by the new Mexican ambassador to Washington, which is to say that immigration reform will not be the horse that pulls the wagon, but rather one of the wheels, that they will pursue a much more aggressive defense of the Mexican interests here in the U.S., that they will try to reclaim a seat in the table of public debate that they think got lost in the previous administrations, and that they probably will use probably use lobbyists and even the consular network to push for those interests and possibly an immigration agenda, but not limited to that. Could you be more specific as to which do you see as the benefits or risks, if any, of this new strategy?
Well, again, Jose, I'm not sure I see the difference. Frankly, I have a lot of difficulty in understanding what the difference is of the new strategy, as articulated very specifically in this interview, which I'm sure you saw, that Sarukhan gave to the Latin American advisor, Political News Mexico, new ambassador Mexico, to lobby for U.S. immigration reform, similar to 93, et cetera, et cetera. I'll give you a copy of this. It's not because he wrote my speeches when I said this and he's just taking out the hard disk and using the same speech. He is, but that's irrelevant. It's the same speech. It's the same strategy. It's the same focus as spelled out here, as said here. Said elsewhere, I don't know. But as said here, it's exactly the same thing. I don't know what they intend to do. So it's very difficult for me to understand whether what they're trying to do. To give you an example, I always thought, and I wrote about this back in the 90s, that the Mexican consular network should be a consular network of mini ambassadors. It was a term I used in something I published in 1997, I think. No, 1987, I'm sorry. That each consul should not limit himself to protecting Mexican citizens. Obviously, he has to do that. But he should go to the local media. He should write op-ed pieces. He should be at the universities, at the Kiwanis Club, at the Lions Club, at this club, at the other. He should be all over the place, or she should be. And this is what we did the first couple of years of the Fox administration. my successor, Luis Ernesto Derbez, decided, because the U.S. administration specifically asked him, asked the Mexican government, to refrain from doing that, they stopped doing it for 4 years. Not just on immigration, on anything. The instructions were consuls have to keep out of the media, keep away from universities. They are not mini ambassadors. They should stick to local defense of Mexican nationals. Now there's a third view, which I don't understand exactly what it is. Because you could lobby for other things, but you have to have something to lobby for if you want to lobby. I mean, there are not 1,000 different things you can have as a consular network or as an ambassador or as a government to lobby for. You have 2, 3, you can't have 50. Because there aren't 50, and because you don't have the money or the time or the interest for 50. I don't know if Mexico has something else on its agenda. I know the United States has many things on its agenda with Mexico, but I'm not sure I know what Mexico has on its agenda with the United States other than immigration. If it has something else, well, then they will, I'm sure, articulate it. But I have a certain amount of difficulty in understanding if there is a new strategy and what it is. I still haven't figured that out, particularly given the very different stances that are being made public now. I don't see, for example, how you can hire lobbyists and be low profile. I mean, the two things, at least in my understanding of how Washington works, are contradictory. Either you have a low profile or you hire lobbyists. I have yet to meet a lobbyist who is a low-profile lobbyist. Now, maybe someone like that will appear. It's not impossible. I would just use that final example that the new ambassador uses, which is a very good one, what Mexico did with NAFTA in 93. Salinas and their team did a very good job of lobbying for NAFTA approval. Granted, they had the best lobbyist in the world heading the effort, President Clinton. It's easier when you've got not only the President of the United States, but someone like Clinton on your side. And I'm not sure what would have happened if Clinton had acted a little bit like Bush is acting on immigration. In other words, I hope it happens, but I'm not going to do a whole lot to make it happen. But they carried out a very costly, very effective, very targeted lobbying effort, district by district, state by state, company by company, to make this happen. And I think it's a very good precedent that the new ambassador is quoting when he refers to this. What I don't see is how that example is compatible with the other view. That's where I have more difficulty understanding. But I hope that that's what the government does, and I hope President Calderon gives the new foreign minister the money Fox never gave me and never gave Derbez to hire the lobbyists that you need here, which are very, very expensive.
Sergio, did you want to comment?
No, Jorge knows this issue much, much better.
Anything you want to say before we're going to end the session, but I wanted to give you at least an opportunity on any issue, any comment based on what's been said at the table.
No, I think we've been concentrating a lot on these foreign policy and foreign policy issues, probably because Jorge is here, and I totally understand it. But first of all, you know, we all know in Mexico, and everyone knows everywhere, that if we're ever going to solve the immigration problem, it's going to have to be through growth in Mexico and the creation of employment in Mexico. So it's basically a domestic economic issue of Mexico. And that issue depends on having structural reforms pushed through Congress. So the idea that we started with the realignment of political parties in Mexico is important. It's important for a reason. I'm a Mexican. I strongly believe in Mexico. I believe Mexico has the wherewithal to be a more prosperous country. But for us to do that, we need to transform Mexico. We need to make it more efficient. We need to make it more competitive. We need to combat corruption. And for us to do that, we really have to push through some reforms through Congress. And the big problem is that we all know what the reforms are. We're not making anything up. We're not inventing anything. Everyone knows what we need to do. And we'll only get those things done if we manage to get three major political parties in Congress to cooperate one way or another. And I hope that we manage to do that.
Okay. Well, as Jorge mentioned, today is my birthday, and I wanted both of them here for that. It's unfortunate that I had to share it with all of you. But nonetheless, I think they both have a sense of humor. They're both very insightful. I've enjoyed the session. I'll consider it a birthday gift from the both of you. And if you can just join me in thanking both of our guests for a good session today.